Welcome to Author Stories, the podcast where we talk to the best writers in the industry and discuss writing and the creative process. Whether you are a writer, a reader, or both, we hope you'll find something here that makes you love books and the writers that create them. You can find archives of all of the great conversations I've had with authors over the years at hankgarner.com. Take some time and browse around there. I'm sure you'll find a new author to love, find inspiration for your own creative life, and find a new story to get lost in. Let's thank some sponsors who make the show possible. As the Crow Flies, Enter Haddon Wood, Book 1 by Risa Walker and Caleb Ansell. From Risa Walker, the award-winning author of the best-selling Kronos Files, and debut author Caleb Ansell, comes a chilling story of altered reality and psychological terror. Chase Ray sits perfectly still, his thumbs traveling across the screen of the broken computer tablet, stuck in the nexus between two worlds. Haddon Wood isn't real. It can't be. Another world, another reality, hovers just beyond his reach. He can see it sometimes. He can almost touch it. In that world, things are in balance. The dead stay dead, and the creature feature remains safely on the screen. That world isn't a patchwork quilt of every scary book or movie he's seen. In that world, the nightmares generally end when you open your eyes and people don't glitch in and out of existence. Chase is determined to return to that world, although he's a bit worried that the only way out is through the noose that seems to lurk around every corner. He needs allies to get back home. But how do you choose your team when you can't tell who's real? As the Crow Flies, Enter Haddon Wood, Book 1 by Risa Walker and Caleb Ansell. Simon Says, the John Simon Thriller, Book 1 by Brian Thomas Schmidt. Master Detective John Simon is a tough, streetwise 17-year veteran of the Kansas City Police Department with a healthy disdain for the encroachment of modern technology into his workplace. When his partner is kidnapped after a routine stakeout by thugs with seeming ties to connected, wealthy art dealer Benjamin Ashman, he's determined to find the truth. But the only witness is a humanoid android named Lucas George. Reluctantly, he takes Lucas along as he begins to investigate and soon finds himself depending more and more on the very technology he so distrusts. Meanwhile, Simon's precocious teenage daughter begins to teach Lucas how to sound more like a cop using dialogue from famous cop movies. If only he'd use them in the appropriate context. This exciting new mix of near-future science fiction and procedural thriller captures the gritty realism of Michael Connelly's Bosch, the humor and action of Lethal Weapon, and follows the classic science fiction tradition of Isaac Asimov's City of Steel. From the editor of the international best-selling phenomenon The Martian by Andy Weir, and the national best-selling author of tales including official entries in The X-Files, Predator, and the Joe Ledger thrillers, comes the action-packed first entry in an exciting new series. Be sure to pick up Simon Says by Brian Thomas Schmidt and get into the series on the ground floor. Vedic by KJ Heritage. The dead don't always die. Top company scientist Chin Jelinek has committed suicide. Vedic, a half-alive empath with no memory of who or what he is, will die in 6 hours if he can't find out why, or so the company tells him, an added incentive to get the job done. Our hero soon discovers he is one of the skilled, a genetically enhanced human revered and despised in equal measure, a bloodhound with a terrifying past who'll stop at nothing in his pursuit of the truth. And the skilled always get their guy, don't they? Vedic, number 1, by KJ Heritage, on sale now. There's a link to it in the show notes. KJ Heritage's uncanny sense of pacing and story puts him at the forefront of today's speculative fiction writers. Gritty, intense, and compelling, Vedic is something you don't run into often enough in sci-fi, a cerebral thrill ride you don't want to end. Prepare to lose sleep reading Vedic, delicious science fiction. That's what other people are saying about it. Find out for yourself. Vedic, the first book in the series by KJ Heritage. The Unwelcome Trilogy by R.D. Brady. survivor, mother, leader, and humanity's last chance. Deep within the remnants of the United States, Lila Richards oversees a camp of 200 survivors. In a world where living is an everyday struggle, and only through banding together can people survive, the arrival of the unwelcome only made her job harder. Riley Quinn and Miles Jones have been raised by Lila for the last 5 years. They're also one of the cursed, the children between the ages of 13 and 18, whom the unwelcome kill on sight. No questions, no pleas, just death. Protecting one another and the people of their camp is ingrained in all of them. But now each of them faces increased danger as the reason why the cursed have been targeted by the unwelcome slowly comes to light. And that truth will shock them to their core. Now time is running out, not just for the cursed who are being hunted down by the unwelcome, not just for Lila and her family who will face the greatest challenge yet, but for all of humanity. The world changed radically 35 years ago, but today humanity's very existence is on the line, and the fight has begun that will ensure its future or its annihilation. Fans of A.G. Riddle, James Rollins, Suzanne Collins, and Brandon Sanderson will love the Unwelcome Trilogy. Pick up your copy of the Unwelcome Trilogy on Amazon today. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to have Joanne Silver Jones on the show with me today. She has a fantastic new book that's out everywhere today, so be sure to grab your copy after you listen to us chat or listen to us on your way to go buy the book. It's called Headstrong, Surviving a Traumatic Brain Injury, and what a fascinating story. Joanne, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining me. Joanne, we begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
It's a great question. I wanted to be a storyteller and to write stories for a very long time. I've always been fascinated by the stories that everybody has, and I was a college professor for my entire professional career, and I ran my classes primarily by having people use their stories as a way to connect to the content, connect to each other. So the idea of the power of storytelling has been in me for a long time. The idea of writing this book is a much more recent occurrence in my life.
Sure. Were you, at what point, as a youngster, do you think that that storytelling really became apparent to you?
It's another great question. Probably my first recollection of that is beginning with graduate school, and I would call myself a youngster. I was only 21, and I was in a Master of Social Work program. And I was meeting people and hearing their stories and learning theories, et cetera. What really engaged me, and I think what enabled me to really engage other people, was my interest and desire to know more of the story and to hear it without judging what it was or where it came from, just the power of it. So it's been with me at least from my early 20s.
So the work that you've done, you say that story is very important, and that you like to have people communicate through their story. What does that look like in practice?
It looks like having people relate to a concept. For example, I taught a number of different kinds of courses, and two in particular, one on understanding race, another on gender. And I would ask people to tell about their early recollections in regard to, say, race, not to say who's got the more difficult story, but what did you learn? Where did you learn it? And what were your reactions? And when was the first time you understood who you were and what your identity was, and what difference did that make, and how do you relate to a character in a book we might be reading? And as people talked about their own recollections without needing to frame it in any particular way, they were able to talk in a much more relaxed fashion and learn a great deal and be surprised by what they hadn't learned, or be surprised that what they learned is the stuff that's written in textbooks, but they didn't have the language to describe it. And always people were incredibly moved by what they learned from each other and how they learned about the world and different perspectives and different ways of living and different places that people live, different generations, by hearing somebody talk about their story, what their grandfather said and why their grandfather felt such and such about certain people. And it really brought what we were doing to a very personal level. And then I would infuse what different authors said and make connections there.
It's really interesting how story and then communicating your personal story really has the ability to free people up to authentically communicate. I think a lot of times when we're talking about difficult subjects or things that seem to have cultural taboos, maybe where people are afraid of saying the wrong thing, And a lot of times that comes from an honest, good place where we honestly don't want to offend someone or don't want to say the wrong thing. And a lot of times those barriers that we construct prevent us from having authentic communication. But it's amazing how story can get past all of that and help us to get to our authentic self.
Absolutely. And it's the story of the person in the room, it's the story of that person's parents, their grandparents, and things that get passed down, and often for very important reasons, to survive, all kinds of reasons. But I completely agree, by having it as a story, it's authentic, it is what it is, and that's honest.
Right. You worked in academia for 25 years, is that right?
For 35 years.
35 years, excuse me.
In Massachusetts, and I was a few other places before that.
Gotcha. During this time, had the thought of writing a book ever occurred to you before then, or had you were you one of those people that was always looking for the right subject matter, or had that just not come up until now?
It occurred to me, it seemed like such a daunting task. I mean, I did writing as part of my professional life. I wrote articles and some chapters in books. A book seemed overwhelming. And I think, like many women, I felt, oh, I'm not up to that task. So I kind of put it in the back of my mind. I was part of a number of writing groups. I loved writing. I loved reading. And I just didn't see that I could do it. It seemed just far too big a task. And then this event happened to me, and I would say that the writing took over, that words just started to come out and form, and then I couldn't stop writing.
Before we get to the book and how this came along, let's visit that that experience that has been the catalyst for the story. And I love the way that the book begins. It's just another day. There's a lot of excitement around Washington and what's going on. And President Obama was just a few days away from being inaugurated. And, you know, you're kind of mulling over your feelings about all of that and the kind of feeling of positivity and energy in the air. And you know, it just seems like a great day. What happened?
It was a fabulous day. And just before the event that changed my life, I was deciding that for dinner I would order lamb shanks slow cooked in red wine. And I could just taste.
Which sounds amazing.
It does. I must do that. I haven't done that yet. And so I was imagining that. I was close to my daughter's house. I could see it. I turned a corner, and then I felt something touch my head. I thought it might be a pebble that a bird kicked down. And I turned around, and I'm not exactly sure what I saw. I saw a glimpse of a young black man in a hoodie, and I felt my entire body like rearranging my, I thought I was going to die. And that was the last thought I had. I had no more thoughts for, I don't know, for a very long time. Apparently he beat me with a hammer. That might have been what I felt on my head. The extraordinary thing about the body is that when in danger, all of these systems take over to protect a person from feeling pain, and it's that survival mode. And I did not feel pain for many hours after I was bludgeoned with a hammer. Astounds me.
That is amazing. There's a lot of lot of lines can be drawn between the physical pain and then the emotional pain that later on we go through by hiding things, and that story again is the great catalyst for helping to deal with those. Were you unconscious at this point?
I was in and out, and I write some recollections in the book, and my closest family members, my daughter and my wife, have said it couldn't have happened. My daughter, who was there about 45 minutes after, said I was unable to say anything or make any sounds. I was making sounds, but no discernible speech. But I have recollections in my head of conversations. So I don't know if they were real or what happens inside the mind at a time like that. I know that I was completely unconscious for a while. I remember trying to lift myself up off the ground. And then I remember being in the ER and seeing a lot of lights flashing. And then I remember being in intensive care and a surgeon saying, it's going to take me to surgery and clean up my head a little. So there were like little tiny blips of consciousness and then nothing except what was in my mind. And I can still remember the images in my mind, not the images around me.
Wow. And how long were you in the hospital?
I was in that hospital for 12 days. Then I was released after having a craniotomy, and both of my hands were fractured, and my hands didn't constitute a life-threatening medical emergency. So I was released and needed to make the journey from Washington, D.C. to Amherst, Massachusetts, where I lived, and then find a surgeon to repair my hands. So after about 2 weeks, I left Washington, and a dear friend paid for a medical van to take me from Washington to Massachusetts. And a week later, I had hand surgery. So a series of hospitalizations, long, long, painful recoveries.
So when you get home and the initial the initial shock has subsided a little bit, and a trauma like that, there's a lot of hubbub around, and people are at your side constantly. Mm-hmm. But there comes a point naturally when anything happens like that, and everyone starts to get back to their life, and routines are. You would get back into normal routines and things like that. But the person that has suffered the trauma is usually sitting there still dealing with this while the rest of the world starts to go on. What was that feeling like, after several weeks and you're still recovering and you're still trying to process all of this going on in your mind? What were some of those times like?
For me, it was after several months because of my hands and the severity of the head injury, I needed 24-hour care. I couldn't do anything for myself. So there were always people around. I couldn't be alone, feeding me, toileting me, making sure I didn't fall. So that was about 5 months of care. And then, as you say, people return to their life. And as my injury healed, as the external appearance of the injury healed, many people would still contact me. And I heard from a lot of people, oh, you look so good. You must be all healed now. You look good. What are you reading? And I would get angry about being told I look good, even though for most of my life I wanted someone to say that, because the injuries were still there, but they were inside of me. And I felt that I wasn't being seen. And I was unable to read, unable to focus, unable to do most anything but sleep. And so normal questions, I didn't really know how to answer gracefully. I would snap or say something. It was a very hard time. I had to really learn to be much more gracious and understand people were just trying to say what they couldn't think of to say and be as kind as they could while being themselves devastated by what happened. It really happens to a wide swath of people. It wasn't only me who suffered this random attack of violence and then a lifetime injury.
Right. From the beginning of the book and the way you personally were feeling at the time before the book, after the trauma happens and during the recovery, when you said you couldn't do anything for yourself, you couldn't read, you couldn't do anything, I would imagine there's a lot of time that's just kind of spent inside your thoughts and replaying things or trying to avoid replaying things, just trying to process, you know, the trauma. How does the recovery period compare to that feeling that you give us in the beginning of the book? Of excitement and, you know, just the happy parts of regular everyday life.
Right. Well, there's no comparison. It's I feel as though my life has been bifurcated. There was that joyous, joyous moment of President Obama is going to be our president. And then after, and for, I don't even, my sense of time is off. It was at least months, maybe years, when very little brought me joy. I didn't really want to go out. I wasn't interested in anything. I watched some of the same TV programs over and over. I didn't want to read. I really wasn't interested in anything. I focused a lot on recovering my physical body. When I could, I went back to yoga and I tried to work out and I pushed myself to walk and I tried to read about traumatic brain injury. It's probably the professor in me. I thought if I could just understand it, then maybe I can deal with it and get all better, which of course it doesn't happen that way. And it was a very hard time on my family because I was just like a wet blanket all the time. And it just was such a hard feeling to have no joy. And I had been someone who got a lot of pleasure out of ordinary things, but nothing really brought me pleasure.
Your experience working with other people in the academic setting and how you showed us a few minutes ago how the importance of story and dealing with the things that are difficult to talk about. At what point did you start realizing that this could be therapeutic, cathartic for you personally?
It was maybe, it was 10 years ago that the assault happened, and I would say it was maybe 5 years into recovery when I was no longer pushed by whatever it is inside of people who have been traumatized to tell the story over and over and over again. People who have just experienced something, they quickly and sort of breathlessly tell their story. And I was getting beyond needing to tell the story, which made me I was getting beyond needing to repeat the story and more able to tell the story as a story with different contexts to it. And as people asked me about it, and particularly when I was part of a writing group, and there was a lot of interest in the story and what, not only what happened, but the person that it happened to. And I began to see that it was something that had a lot of value for a lot of people. And the other thing I realized as I looked for things to read and things to help me is I had a hard time finding written material that were stories, that was about the intimate personal struggle that people had. Found a lot of professional writing, which was useful. I wanted to know, what did somebody else go through? What did they feel? What were they afraid of? When was there a change? What helped them? And I really couldn't find that. So my writing has been a way, and I hope it does prove to be a way, that other people can see themselves in my story. And TBI is something that affects, you know, tens and tens of thousands of people, as does PTSD.
When at what point did you start writing down your experience with it? And from the beginning, was the recording of what happened and your thoughts about it, was that more for you, or did you realize, because you couldn't find the kinds of stories that you're looking for, that yours was going to be so important in the world?
When I started to jot down things, it was for me. It was like I used to do when I'd keep a journal. I would only keep a journal if I was heartbroken or something happened. Then I would just frantically write, you know, so-and-so did such and such, and, you know, I'm the best and that person's the worst, something like that. So I was writing about what happened and my ideas and my suffering. And as it went along, I realized that I was writing a lot and this was growing. And I then had the desire to actually write a book. And I realized that I couldn't do this alone, that it's very private and writing is a very solitary experience. But it needed, I thought, to be done in the company of others. And I was so fortunate to find a manuscript, a year-long manuscript writing group a few miles from my house, run by Dori Ostermiller. And she, you had to submit writing to her, and she would only select six people. And I was fortunate to be selected and spent a year writing. It was a very demanding group. We had to write 40 pages every 2 weeks and read everybody else's. And the more I wrote and the more I got feedback, the more levels I could reach. And then I was grabbed, the book had grabbed me, and it was just part of my constant thinking and was now giving me such a strong foundation to stand on. It really was something that I hope people go out and buy the book, absolutely. But the process of writing it and now getting it out has been a phenomenal and rewarding experience.
When you're working on this book and it started to become a book in your mind, did you have an end in sight? Did you know what the window was going to be? Because the book is obviously about your life and it's about your journey through this. But did you know where the beginning and ending would be? What that specific window that we would look into your life would be?
Initially, I had an idea that it would be the bounded by the first term of office of President Obama. It had a time frame. I wasn't telling my whole life story. At least that's how I began. And the idea of segments and chapters came to me very quickly. I just they came to me, and I wrote them down. And those titles actually have stayed through many years. But things happened during the time that I was writing, large events, and that I felt needed to be included. And I became very aware that in order to be honest to what happened, I had to dig into my own history and tell the backstory, not just as a writing device, but its importance to how I dealt with what happened to me, what slowed up my recovery, and what enabled me to move forward. I didn't have an ending in clear sight. The more I wrote, things just became clearer and clearer. It was like I would move a little bit and a light would shine and I would know what to do next. And then an event happened, as I tell toward the end of the book, on an airplane flight, and I knew how to end it.
That's fantastic. You were talking about the importance of the backstory, and you talk about in the book, you know, a therapist who began to help you put some of the pieces together. And that's something that I found, you know, very fascinating when you start working through, you know, a traumatic time, that the healing process usually, the focus changes from this one particular incident to kind of this broader spectrum of how we relate to that incident and the things that cause us to relate in certain ways to that incident and then to people around us. It's really fascinating. And this book is the perfect vehicle to kind of help us change focus on that. How important was it to you to make sure that you included those aspects of the story, the things that weren't necessarily so tightly focused on the particular incident that's the catalyst for this?
It was extremely important to me because I strongly believe that nothing happens outside of a context. And the fact that I was beaten by a black man just before the inauguration of a black man played an important part in the kind of responses I got, particularly from white supremacist groups. It played a large part in my professional career, which had been always around racial justice and my family's upbringing. And I think it's important for everybody actually to see how the context in which something happens plays a role. And I didn't want to tell a story of something terrible, terrible happened to me, and then I recovered. Not that those are bad stories at all, but in terms of how I see the world, I needed to do more than that. And I hope that in reading it, other people can also explore their own backgrounds and the things that have impacted their lives and that contribute to what's happening and how they're dealing with the healing. I think that's true for a lot of traumas, and this happens to be the one in my life. And I know that traumatic brain injury, certainly the kind that I have, is a forever disease. It will not leave me. It will always have certain repercussions. And so I need to learn how to handle something that's ongoing, how to find a way to remake my life in a way that gives me a positive and joyful path. And I hope that others can explore themselves and find that. And it'll be different for a lot of people. But I think it's important. I think it's important for everybody, because we don't do something in isolation from what our early experiences are and what our world context is.
The book is called Headstrong, Surviving a Traumatic Brain Injury. This is such a fantastic book on so many levels. Joanne, I'm going to send everyone to pick up a copy of this book. If people are just discovering you and your story, is there a place where they can connect with you online?
Absolutely. I have a web page. It's joannejonesauthor.com. And there are ways to reach me on that page. I'm also on Facebook. Friend me. I will be a good friend and return the accept the request. And I'm also on Twitter. So on all those vehicles, you can connect with me and I will respond. And I'm very happy to talk with people individually. Every time I have spoken someplace, there are always several people who are dealing with traumatic brain injury and some also with being the victims of random violence and want to talk. And I'm happy to do that. I really hope my experience can be useful to other people. We're in this together.
Absolutely. Joanne, we're going to put links to all of the your website and your Facebook in the show notes of this episode, and especially to the book Headstrong: Surviving a Traumatic Brain Injury. Joanne, this has been so much fun chatting with you today. Thank you for taking time to come on the show.
Thank you for inviting me. I loved it.
Now stay tuned for an audiobook excerpt from Richard Gleaves, the Jason Crane series.
"I'm melting! I'm melting!"
cried Joey.
"Take the picture already!"
He stood with one arm around the bronze waist of the bewitched tribute statue, Samantha Stevens, riding a broom across a crescent moon. Jason tried in vain to frame the shot without any tourists in it, but that was impossible. From all points of the compass, a merry horde had arrived for Salem's two-day summer psychic fair. All the commuter trains had burst open, like cornucopias filled beyond capacity, spilling endless fruits and nuts onto the red brick sidewalks of Essex Street. A vampirist in lavender shorts and feathered boots sold maple chocolate walnut fudge in front of the Witch City Tattoo Parlor. A near-naked gypsy in purple-green veils danced with a pheasant in her arms around a plug-in Hanukkah menorah. A fat man in a fetching blue jeans dress sold amethyst and citrine charm bracelets in front of Medusa Cafe, but his stand got knocked over by a one-armed crone driving a mobility scooter who sang, "Choo-choo!" as she passed, her stump on the wheel, her lipstick ghastly, her gnarled right hand raised in trailing plumes of noxious cigarette smoke. Chewbacca leapt out of her way and slapped sparks from his fur. He gave a disgruntled growl before going back to playing Summer Lovin' on his ukulele. The old one-armed dervish drove off, "Choo-choo!" parting a crowd of wanderers, slack-jawed tourists with camera straps tight across their bellies, yellow-vested police on segways, elderly rollerbladers, face-painted infants and harried parents, and college girls. So many hot, hysterical college girls that you'd think somebody had napalmed a sorority house.
"Jason, are you deaf?"
"Sorry." Jason raised the phone and took the shot. Joey inspected the photo and nodded in approval.
"Your turn."
"No, thanks."
"Do it, Shaggy. Don't make me hex you."
Jason gave in and traded places. He put an arm around Samantha's metal back. Her bronze body had flushed in the afternoon sun, warm through his glove, but her eyes were weary. No, downright creepy. And her smile was forced, like a Disneyland princess who'd had her toe stomped.
"Say chowder,"
cried Joey, who'd been practicing his New England accent all morning.
"Come on, man. Say chowder."
"Fine, chowder." Joey got the shot, and Jason surrendered Samantha to a chubby kid wearing a Gandalf beard who climbed up to worship her bronze bosom.